today we're going to talk largely about the problems, the consequences, the politics, and the economics that led to where we are now, and the philosophical divide, political divide over how to address the problems, and underlaying all of that, the values of what we expect out of a healthcare system. Then tomorrow, talk about the solution, one I'm proposing, a Minnesota proposal to meet the healthcare needs of everyone. And again, I'm certainly open to other ways, but it has to meet those basic values that we talk about, we'll talk about later today. And healthcare reform is not only a complicated issue, but it's a highly, highly contentious issue. Healthcare is now 16% of our nation's economy. That's big. It's massive in terms of this, one out of every six or so dollars in our economy is going to healthcare, and it's growing at double-digit rates most years, about three or four times faster than inflation every year for the last 30, 40 years. And because it's highly contentious, there's a lot of strong feelings about it. It's not so much, at least in Minnesota, it's not clear-cut Democrats are over here, Republicans over there, but it's very partisan in terms of basic differences in philosophical views. And the part of the reason for dividing this into two topics and focusing on the problem, the consequences of the problem, and the values of what we expect in the healthcare system is that when you have the highly contentious debate where nobody wants to, where everybody's arguing and nobody's listening, I think the thing to do is, instead of figuring out how we're going to get where we're going, the first thing to do is look at where we want to go. You can't map out something if you don't know what the destination is, and yet too much of our healthcare debate starts out with the I believe this, the ideological approach that maps where you're going rather than the figure out where you want to go first. The best way to describe when I said earlier that the healthcare system, I put system in quotes, we have an executive who's been involved in healthcare issues in Minnesota, works for General Mills, does their personnel stuff, and so he's heavily engaged, as all personnel people are, in healthcare benefits. A guy named Tom Forsyth, he spoke to our Healthcare Access Commission this past year and said, if you tried to design a healthcare system that didn't work, you couldn't have done a better job. As soon as I say the first half of the line, everybody can see what's coming because it isn't a working system. And in the U.S., we spend a lot and we have very excellent leadership in terms of both the highest skilled people in terms of research and product development and medical technology and best doctors and medical providers in the world. People come to Minnesota even for Mayo Clinic is one of the best places in the world to get health care. So we have great health care, but a lousy system to give people access to it. And before getting into the specifics of the problems and so on, a group in Minnesota, Isaiah is the name of the group. It's, as the name may imply, it's a religious group. It's an interfaith group that is talking, trying to get public conversation on public policy issues of people concerned with faith about. And they spelled out this past year, they've had all these groups that have been talking about healthcare. And they put together a series of, I think they call them their vision, I'd say it's sort of their value statement, by which how we look at healthcare now and how they think we ought to be looking at it. And I'll have my Elson and Connie can try and go over it. We reject, I don't know if you can see that, they will read them too. We reject what we believe. And so maybe you can just go through these.
We reject that healthcare is an individual problem that requires individualized solutions.
We believe that healthcare is a community problem that calls for community solutions.
We reject that there is a society, a scarcity of resources in the healthcare system, and that scarcity prevents us from providing good healthcare to everyone.
We believe that there are plenty of resources in our healthcare system, but they are not distributed properly to meet our community's needs.
And on that, I'm going to interrupt to say, in terms of whether we have enough resources in the healthcare system, the U.S. is almost double the average of what other industrialized nations spend on health. They do deliver health care to everyone, and most of those countries deliver health care. They mean not just, oh, you go to the doctor, but they also take care of your dental care, which for some reason we distinguish from the rest of healthcare here. They take care of mental health care, prescription drugs. But we spend in this country over $7,000 per person per year on health care. You probably don't see that much coming out of your pocket, so you don't think about it that way, but our family of four, that's $28,000 that our country is spending on health care for four people. It's a lot of money. It's about double, as I said, almost double. Most of the countries, European countries and so on, are about 60% of what we spend. But I think the second most expensive, sizable country, if you exclude like Luxembourg, Switzerland is, I think, second most expensive, and they are less than two-thirds what we spend. They're more like 65%. So significantly less, and again, we are the only industrialized nation that doesn't provide health care. But when we're spending $7,000 a person, almost twice everybody else, maybe that is enough, and I think that's what Isaiah is trying to say here.
We reject that health care is a zero-sum game in which giving one person access to health care requires it be taken away from someone else.
We believe that universal health care is both necessary and achievable.
We reject that access to health care should be granted based on wealth.
We believe that access to health care should be granted based on need.
And here again, we're the only country in the world that steers its health care to based on the money, not on where the medical need is. We don't. As a matter of fact, we're the opposite of that. We actually spend money in this country to underwrite health care, which may make sense when you're underwriting a homeowner's insurance, but for health care, we basically spend money to make sure that the sicker you are, the more difficult it's going to be for you to be able to afford health care. We actually try and do it the opposite of what you should want, which is access based on your need, not based on the needier you are, the more likely you're going to be to not be able to afford it because we're going to charge you more if you can get insurance at all.
We reject that market-based competition is the ultimate solution to achieve the best possible value from our healthcare system.
We believe that we can achieve greater value for our healthcare resources than what market-based competition alone can provide.
We reject that our healthcare system should be designed to address acute healthcare problems.
We believe that our healthcare system should be designed to achieve healthy communities.
And on that, I think we ought to focus when we're talking about healthcare very much, something that we often ignore, we give a lot of lip service to, but prevention. The goal, our healthcare is very much focused on acute care. When you're sick, you go to the doctor. Very little on getting preventive care, getting help earlier on to keep people healthy. Vaccinations, perhaps, to avoid flu, other issues in terms of keeping weight under control and smoking cessation. That's one small part of prevention, but again, keeping people healthy is a lot better for a healthcare system than waiting till they're sick.
We reject that healthcare is a private good, and decisions about the healthcare system should be made by the private market, which is primarily motivated by profit.
We believe that healthcare is a public good, and decisions about the healthcare system should be made democratically by the public because it is our health at stake.
Now, this is, again, as I said, this is a, I think it actually says at the top of it, draft, because it's their year-old version. I don't know if they've changed it. But Isaiah is an interfaith organization that tries to raise these issues from perspectives of faith. And so I guess I just quickly open it up, see if there are any comments or questions about this, or if thoughts of things that they didn't talk about or whatever? Just real quickly, there are obvious things that you...
We can achieve much greater value than what market-based can provide. What does that mean exactly?
Okay, what they're saying there is that if we're talking just the market controlling healthcare costs, they believe that's not the best way to deliver good value. One quick example of that in Minnesota, Maplewood, Minnesota, there is a healthcare, a hospital, St. John's Hospital, and they have a radiation therapy thing for people with cancer and so on, where they beam radiation at you and so on. Very, very expensive facilities. The state of Minnesota actually limits where you can put these nowadays because there's so many of them, but they're highly profitable. So a lot of the doctors who work there teamed up with some outside investors, and they decided we'll put our own radiation therapy clinic across the street, literally across the street from the hospital, and then you refer patients to there. That's the way the market works for them. They can steer people to there, and they make money. The rest of the hospital is suffering from it, and while there's a shortage of these facilities in some places, you have two of them across the street from each other, and they're saying sometimes the market is a good way of determining people deciding whether they're going to make money on something or not, but it's not necessarily a good way of determining how you provide health care. And I'll give more examples of that later. Other comments or whatever?
I just wanted to say that I'm one of the leaders of the Isaiah healthcare work that's being done, and Barb is here too. Barb, you want to just identify yourself? So we're both leading some of this work, and if anybody's interested in sort of how we're doing this process, we're really organizing in churches. Yesterday, a lot of us talked about being cynical, and I do this work because I don't want to be cynical, and I sort of think that's a choice, and it's very, very exciting. And then when we have people like John Marty, we can actually imagine that.
Go ahead.
The statement opposes need versus wealth as the basis for access to healthcare, but that doesn't deal with specifically with the issue of basically we have an employment-based access system.
This doesn't get to the point of who's providing where we get our health coverage, which in our country is a very good point. It's falling, but it's the majority of people get their health care through their employment, which causes problems with the economy as well. But in Minnesota, I think we dropped from 65% of the population getting their health care of the total population getting their health care from employers down to 62% in the last 5 or 6 years. And interestingly, that shows up because when you talk about who is without health insurance altogether, last year, between I think it was 2005, 2006, most recent numbers that came out. So there was an increase of about 1.2 million people without health insurance coverage over that year period of time. It's about 46 million nationwide. But 1.2 million people increase in that number in 1 year. Over 1.1 million of them, over 1 million, it was close to 1.1 million of them, were people who had above the median income, over 50-some thousand-dollar households per year, which is the median for the country. Those folks, majority, almost all the people in that year who grew, the demographic group that grew, the number of uninsured, were people above average. In my mind, that's attributable to the fact that businesses are dropping coverage or cutting back, increasing the co-payments, the premiums, the employees pay. So that's it's a good point. This isn't designed to talk about that, but I think that when you talk about based on need, we can't forget that. Anything else real quick then? Yes?
Well, I've got just two quick comments. First of all, I'm going to play a little devil's advocate. I don't mean to be. I'm a nurse. I'm a Quaker. We really believe in egalitarian. Everybody should have access to the same thing. But the second to the last bit here, as a nurse, I know that the medical profession lives on their own studies. You have to be able to study something, and you can't prove health. You can't show that people are well. You know what I mean? In a study, you could say, "Oh, we have this many cancer patients. and we gave them this, we did this trial, we did this trial, these people did better, so we stopped this trial, and we all went on the safe trial for them. But there's no way to study whether or not birds, or at least it's
how healthy, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll agree with you to a point that there's no good way to measure overall health. So what we do use, we use some, the two most common ones are infant mortality rate, which we're not doing very good on, and life expectancy also. But yes, you can't, it's very hard to say how healthy is the Holden community this week. How to quantify is very difficult. You can see a lot of it. You can see mental health when it's not being met in the community, which our country as a whole does a very poor job at. You can see lots of the problems, but that's, and it's more than anecdotal when you see it that way. It's, you can see it in the population at large, but it's very hard to put a pinpoint measurement there. I'll agree with you.
So I'm just playing the other side of it. I totally agree with what you're saying here.
Yesterday you had mentioned the PBS series talking about healthcare and other. Another wonderful PBS series is called Unnatural Causes. Is Inequality Making Us Sick? And that is an excellent one to see how healthy, what healthy communities are. And if you're not living in a healthy community, which means access to quality food, access, you know, their living conditions. So if you can plug into that PBS series, also gives you...
That's a good point. I have not seen it, but I heard about it a month ago or so, and I think it's been, it was in the last 2-3 months.
Yes, it was March and April, but I know that that's at least in the state of Minnesota, and I think around the country that there have been public nurse associations, visiting nurses, all of those public health nurses that are zeroing in on that to understand the, what a healthy community is.
Right. Anyway, this is just spelled out to say where one group in Minnesota has come out on what we're doing now versus what we should be expecting out of the healthcare system. And with that in mind, I wanted to quickly go over the problems and consequences of our healthcare system or non-system. First one is the most obvious one to me is the cost and the impact. First, I'll talk the impact of the cost on families, on businesses, on government. In Minnesota, and it's probably true in 49 other states as well, schools are having great financial difficulties. And the number one, well, the main expense in the school district is personnel. And by far, the fastest growing portion of any cost school districts have, faster than energy costs, except for this past year, has been healthcare costs. University of Minnesota a few years ago, our governor said how we had increased funding for them by $51 million, which was a reasonable percentage increase to them, and saying, he was saying how generous we had been to them. And the president of the University of Minnesota pointed out that their health care costs for their employees had gone up by like $57 million. More than the entire increase that we were giving them as a state that we thought was generous. They were saying their health care costs alone that year had gone up by more than we were giving them in total new money. So it is very hard hitting on schools and government agencies. It's very, very hard hitting on businesses. That's why a lot of employers are dropping their coverage. And it's very hard hitting on families. It's not just the number one cause of bankruptcy in this country, it's the main cause. It's more than half of all bankruptcies are caused by health care. And that's not those low-income people, that's the people, 76% of them are people who had health care insurance. At least they had health care insurance at the time of an illness or injury or whatever that drove them into bankruptcy. And our system is designed in a way that facilitates people going bankrupt for it. Right in Minnesota and most states, if you are under a certain age, you're able to be covered by your parents if you're a full-time student. Minnesota, it was to age 25, you could be under your parents' policy if you were a full-time student. Unfortunately, we began changing that last year because there are a lot of full-time students, 21-year-old kids and so on, are full-time students, and they get cancer. Not a lot, but some get cancer. When you get cancer, you go through chemotherapy. Of all things, you can't take a full-time load at school if you can take any courses. So you're not a full-time student anymore, so you lose your health care coverage. I mean, at the worst time. I mean, that's one of the examples of how the impact on it. But it does drive people to bankruptcy. It is middle America. It's most families, whether they know it or not, most middle-income families are one illness away from bankruptcy. The cost issue has a big impact on access. I mentioned earlier, 46 million Americans have no health care coverage. and at least that many may have coverage, but they can't get the health care they need. And that's due to the premiums they can't afford. The employer says you got to pay 3/4 of the premiums. We'll subsidize it a little, but you know, if your salary's not, your income's not high enough to pay the premiums, you don't get the insurance at all. If the co-payments or deductibles are so high you can't get it, you don't do it. One of my colleagues in the Minnesota House of Representatives ran for office because of her experience with access and how it hit her. She thought that co-payments, she had her typical plan, they were lower middle income, and she had insurance through her husband's work. Typical thing, $900 a month was their family premium, $30 a visit copay, $3,000 maximum out of pocket. And she had a daughter had major spinal surgery, and next day while she's sitting by her daughter's bedside, a hospital worker came and said, "We want to talk about how you're going to pay your bill." She said, "Well, I got insurance." Well, yeah, that's true, but they were covering $70,000 of a $130,000 surgery, and where you can get the other $60,000. So again, this woman had the health care access, but she wouldn't have it after that under the current system. So it's exclusions because of excluded coverage. Dental care is an obvious one. People have health insurance, but they don't cover dental care because we treat that as an extra. And the fact that we have these high costs means people aren't covered. Minnesota, as I said, we're considered a model state. We had, at least until a year ago or so, the highest number of people with some sort of health care coverage, 93%. That means 340,000 Minnesotans were without any kind of health care coverage whatsoever. Of course, you go to the emergency room, they'll treat you, but you have no health coverage of any kind. And the trouble with talking about the uninsured is of the insured in Minnesota, probably more than a quarter, more than 25% of all Minnesotans that have health insurance can't afford the medicine they need, they can't afford the treatment they need because it's excluded coverage, they can't afford the co-payments. So they have insurance, but they don't have health care that they need. So it's far more than the 7%, it's probably 30-some percent of the Minnesota population that can't get the care they need when they need it. That gets to the fact that health insurance is not health care. There's a big distinction between the two, and we ought to keep that in mind. And then we have, so cost has a big impact on our access. Other, go ahead.
John, the cost accounting in medicine is atrocious, smoke and mirrors. Has anybody come up with an actual measurement of what the costs are? If you go in with an insurance company and you have a $100,000 bill, the insurance company pays $30,000 because they negotiated that contract. You went in without insurance, you'd be expected to pay the $100,000 out of your pocket. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors going on in cost.
Yes, some of that I agree. I don't know if I'd call it smoke and mirrors because it's not intentionally trying to hide something. In pharmaceuticals, it's an attempt to hide things.
But there's no cost accounting.
There's no cost accounting because the way we control costs in our current system is by negotiation. A health plan that you're a member of negotiates costs. I had neck surgery a year ago. I just found the paper that said what the bill was. It was less than $21,000. But the health plan was paying just under $7,000. The rest of it, the hospital and doctor was swallowing because that's what they were negotiating. And as you said, if I didn't have the health plan, I'd be responsible for the whole thing. But frankly, if I couldn't afford it, everybody else's insurance goes up because the hospital charges more for everybody else. But it is smoke and mirrors in terms of what you see, what you versus what the cost is. And we have massive cost shifting, so it's a big problem. But the high cost is driving people out. That's why we have 46 million people with no insurance in the country, and at least that many more who have insurance but not the medical care. The other big thing that has an impact on access is shortage of providers. And this is kind of a patchwork thing. Dental care is a problem in much of the country. Some of the problem is often that people may have, especially through the public programs, they may have dental coverage, but no dentist will see them because the reimbursement rate is not enough. So that's part of the problem. In Minnesota, we've heard from people testifying that they've had to travel 2 hours to get a basic dental treatment, a basic checkup and a filling, 2 hour drive each way. And that means for a lot of people who don't have a lot of money, and people who then have to find transportation, 2 hours, that's a lot of gas, and you spend an entire day doing it, day off work. It's a real problem that makes the system worse because of the fact you can't get it. But we have a real shortage of dental care, and nobody does much about that. Psychiatrists, at the high end, very highly specialized people, psychiatrists, there's a very big shortage. I think that's true throughout the country. Mental health professionals of every level, there's a shortage of. Primary care providers, there's a big shortage of as well, especially in rural communities, but there is a shortage just about everywhere. In our medical schools, at one point we're trained, I think this is true in most European countries, you have like twice as many general practitioners as you have specialists, and here we have sort of the inverse of that, about twice as many specialists as general practitioners.
Why do they think that's so?
Why? Financial. If you're going through 4 years of medical school and 3 years of residency and whatever else, you tend to get paid twice, three times as much based on whether if you have a specialty or general practice, which of course drives people into doing something. That's where the market in terms of an individual physician in med school decides, how am I going to pay off a couple $100,000 of medical debt? Practice in a small town, family practice, you're not going to make enough. A few things, the federal government, some states have programs to loan forgiveness types of things to help with that. If you'll practice in an underserved community, we can do that. But that's largely driven by the fact that nobody's out there thinking ahead saying, we have a shortage of this. And it's not just the highly trained people, it's not just the doctors, it's not just the advanced practice nurses, it's not just the RNs or the LPNs. Medical technologists, we have a great choice. Those are the people who do the lab tests. When you have a blood test, who measures the results? Who tests that up? The Mayo Clinic and University of Minnesota both produce some in Minnesota, but I think as of 2-3 years ago, they were producing about 35 new technologists a year, and there was a backlog in the metro area alone of like 200, about 6 years production of them, and the need was growing faster than we're producing. Nobody's in charge. University of Minnesota is actually shutting down its medical technology program where most of those 35 came from. We fought to intervene with that and so, well, we don't see it as quite our mission. Well, somebody's got to have it as a mission, but we have a shortage of providers. And then when we talk about how cost and provider shortage has an impact on access, access has an impact on health, and then health has an impact on cost, so it becomes a vicious circle. Despite the fact we spend twice as much as other countries, when we get to those measurements, infant mortality, we are much worse than the higher infant mortality rate than other industrialized countries. I believe we're 37th in infant mortality. We're also very low in terms of life expectancy. Life expectancy, obviously you go to countries, third world countries, life expectancy may be 35 or 40 years. Here it's in the upper 70s, but again, a 6-year differential between us and some other countries is significant, and that's one of the ways we measure how we're doing is health. And as I mentioned in the title that was up on the board, this has another impact on health as people don't get the care they need, period. National Academy of Sciences estimates 18,000 people die every year in this country because they cannot afford access to health care. That's 6 times as many people were killed 9/11. If you figure what 9/11 set off for our country to respond to that, if we put 1/6 of that kind of effort into fixing our healthcare system, we could save an awful lot of lives. 18,000 is a statistic. We think of people in terms of individuals, and we know stories. The dental care access issue, we've learned a lot more how dental problems can cause. Some say heart disease even. It certainly can cause major impacts on your health overall. In Minnesota last year, there were 22,000 emergency room visits from people for dental problems. Almost all of them would have been preventable by seeing a doctor. And it does kill people. I remember nationwide, there was a big scandalous story about a 12-year-old kid in Maryland, DeMont driver, African-American kid, an 8-year-old brother who also had dental problems. Mother was, they had medical assistance, Medicaid, and they had dental coverage, but the reimbursement rates in Maryland were such they couldn't find a dentist. Mother was struggling to find one. She was trying to, you have to take a day off work every time you could get one, and then something would happen, they couldn't do it. She was focusing on her 8-year-old kid, and the 12-year-old's problem got worse. She tried everything. Eventually, the infection spread, caused major brain problems. They had emergency surgery, very delicate surgery, $250,000 surgery, and DeMont died anyway. That's an $80 filling, and we spent $250,000 and lost his life. I was telling that story in northern Minnesota, and some of the healthcare people, community, public health people were saying, yeah, that happens here too. It tends to be with senior citizens, and they die, and they're older, and we don't talk about it a lot, but they die from it. And we don't talk a lot about the impact on any case. There was an article in the Minneapolis paper, a couple articles about 3-4 months ago, about a young girl, I think 11 or 12-year-old girl, who died from the flu. And she had asthma. Her mom wanted to give her a flu shot, but said, and it was buried in the article, it wasn't a big thing, but it said, yeah, she didn't give her flu vaccination because she couldn't afford it. This was a working mother. She had insurance, but the vaccination's an extra $15 or whatever. She didn't get it because of the $15. That's another kid who died because of lack of access to health care. As I said, that lack of access causes problems to get worse. We spend more because of that, because it costs more. We have fewer people insured. We have less access to it. So it is a vicious circle. Nobody's in charge of our system. It's confused. It's a wasteful system. We spend in this country 31 cents of every healthcare dollar on administrative costs. I told you earlier that $7,000 a year we're spending per person. I didn't get into that enough. It's because that's what you pay through premiums, what you pay through co-payments, deductibles, what your employer pays, what government pays for its own employees, for school employees, and what we pay through Medicare, Medicaid, all the public programs combined, we're spending $7,000. If 31 cents of every dollar is that, that's over $2,000 each of us is spending on paperwork, paper shuffling, that does not deliver health care. Some of that goes into those $100 million salaries at UnitedHealthcare. Some of it goes into just paper shuffling. Every doctor's office, every clinic has multiple administrators to deal with paying many people many different rates.
Can I just
say,
I work at a psychiatric hospital in Dallas, and it's not that large of a hospital. We have 2 full-time employees whose job is just to walk around and say, okay, this insurance company won't pay anymore, you know. And they walk through and tell the doctor, okay, this one has to be discharged, this one has to be discharged, this, you know.
It is telling them what care to give you. They're not even, they're not collecting the money.
Right.
You have separate people for collecting.
Informing the doctor they aren't going to pay, so start writing the discharge out. Nothing to do with,
And that's $2,000. And by the way, when we count that $2,000 a person for that, that 31 cents on the dollar doesn't count our time. The time you spend filling out the forms and so on, that doesn't count. That's free. It's because you're doing it.
These rules and regulations being automatized out of the healthcare providers, because you can be put in jail for giving somebody free service, because that's against Medicare law. Or charging them less. The rules and regulations are inhuman.
We have a lot of counterproductive regulations. Again, the biggest problem is probably what you mentioned, where people are deciding care based on what's covered and what's not covered. Minnesota used to be known for its good care for chemical dependency. We're not anymore. We're one of the worst states in it because of our reimbursement system. The private plans and the state have reimbursed so little for it that if you have severe heroin addiction, you might get 3 weeks inpatient care, which probably means you're going to fail and then be worse off next time around. But we make our medical decisions very largely on that. But among other types of things I mentioned earlier, how we spend money to underwrite so we can figure out, I mean, the way it's always sold to us, we underwrite. So if you're healthier and younger, you pay less. But obviously the converse is true. You're sicker and you're older, you're going to pay more. And the biggest problem related to the underwriting is lot of people can't get coverage at all because they have what's known as pre-existing conditions. And I think if you look at an extensive enough list, you will find that probably almost all of us have some family member who has something that could qualify as a pre-existing condition. Cancer screenings where you know certain gene mutations, people don't want to talk about that because fear that they're not going to be covered for that. Laws are changing to protect against that, but that's the way it goes. A couple other things that just show how messed up the system was. We were in Mankato in south central Minnesota last year, had a guy come up at a hearing. Just, we were asking for stories, and he told about Lupron, which is a shot for prostate cancer. He said he got one. It was once every 3 or 4 months to get the shot, $1,200, and he was stunned by the cost of that. But his doctor in New Ulm, 30 miles away, said, it's time for your next shot. And he said, okay, I'll set up an appointment to go back to Mankato next week and get one. He said, oh, you can get one right here in New Ulm. And so he signed up, got the shot, and he got a $9,530 bill for a $1,200 shot. Difference in pricing? Well, a whole range of factors, including the federal government's refusal to negotiate. I mean, actual in law, Congress wrote that you cannot negotiate on Medicare prices. This guy didn't have to worry about it. He had all but $200 was paid for by his health plan and Medicare, but he had $30 whatever co-payment, and that's it. Duluth, I know a couple of doctors are here from Duluth. The Duluth St. Mary's Clinic has a program. It's seen as a model. It was presented to our Healthcare Access Commission last year. Model on heart failure. That is a great name for a program. They call it a heart failure program, but it was very successful. Very successful at dealing with people who had heart failure, who had damage to their hearts, heart attack or whatever. It was intensive intervention from people who had already had heart failure, and it did an amazing job. It was intensive team approach where nurses would call people every day. They'd actually put in their homes an electronic scale that would give their weight over the phone to them. They'd get a call every day, are you keeping to your protocol, what you're supposed to be doing. It had a tremendous impact, 80% reduction in rehospitalization. It cut costs by almost half. Why doesn't everybody do this? Well, they were losing money on it because the health plans did not provide coverage for those nurse consultations, those extra things. So they were actually losing money providing a program that saved lives and cost half as much. So to address these problems and develop a good healthcare system, I took longer on this than I wanted. Quickly want to go through some principles that we put together to try and spell out what we think a reformed healthcare system should look like. And we'll just go through these quickly. Just go ahead.
Go ahead.
I'm trying to be like those teachers, you know? Okay. One step at a time. Okay, in order to keep Minnesotans healthy and provide the best quality of health care, our health care system must, number one, ensure all Minnesotans receive high quality health care, regardless of their income.
And I'll point out quickly, there's a distinction there, a very clear one, between health coverage or health insurance and health care, because, as I mentioned earlier.
Number two, not restrict, delay, or deny care or reduce the quality of care to hold down costs, but instead reduce costs through prevention, efficiency, and reduction of bureaucracy.
And on that, efficiency includes things like not using the emergency room when you should be using regular doctor visit, not going to emergency room for dental care. And with that, rationing always comes up when we're talking about healthcare. We very much ration healthcare in this country. People don't get the healthcare they need because they can't afford it largely. But I don't think rationing, some people say, oh, we're going to have it eventually. But I don't think rationing is appropriate function for government. And maybe it is with certain highly technical, totally experimental things. But you get in real dangerous ground when you have either insurance companies or government deciding where you ration care. I think rationing care should be done by the doctor and the patient determining it. Doctor telling the patient, this does not have much chance of success. The patient saying, I've got an advance directive, a living will, if I am dying, if I've got terminal cancer and I'm in pain and my heart stops beating, do not resuscitate me. 90% of the people want that. They do not want to have their heart resuscitated. But unless you have the directive to the hospital, they will do so. We spend a lot of money on that. People tend not to want overcare. There are people who overuse the system. It's a real problem, but we also have the opposite.
With the DNR, a lot of times it gets it doesn't get in the charts. The DNR, DNI, often it is missed in the charts. So as a consumer or family,
make sure they know.
You have to really look for that. Or the loved one who doesn't want to be resuscitated will be.
Right.
And plus, the hospital I work for has the official policy of not honoring them.
See, that's where we actually, a couple of years ago, with blood, with organ donation, we actually have a thing where you have it on your driver's license. So I found out that in Minnesota hospitals, they won't honor that unless they can get some family member to confirm it. I was offended that. I wanted to do a bill to change that. And when the organ transplant company that supervises it for the Midwest was kind of opposed to it because they thought people would object to it. It was only when a cancer survivor who had a transplant, kidney transplant, I think she had, came in and said that that she started pushing it and we changed the law. You have to actually tell a hospital to do what the person wants. Mm-hmm. And again, it tends to be we're going to spend more than the person wants, but I think that's where rationing should occur. Anyway, I'm spending more time than I wanted on some of these.
Number three. Cover all necessary care, including all coverage currently required by law. Complete mental health services, chemical dependency treatment, prescription drugs, medical equipment and supplies, dental care, long-term care, and home care services.
It's interesting. Most health reforms don't even talk about the expansion, the level of service you have. We've got major reforms being talked about in Minnesota now. None of them talk about dental care. Well, we talk about lack of dental access on the side. They try and do some little things to help with that. But we don't talk about whether dental care should be treated the same as others. Or prescription drugs, the federal government stepped in its very clumsy way, politically charged way of doing it. But in my mind, I think when people believe health care, if you think somebody has a right to health care, it should involve your teeth as much as your toes. It should be comprehensive, but that's one of the principles we've set out for what we think should be in it. Go ahead.
Number four, allow patients to choose their own providers. Number five, be funded through premiums and other payments based on the person's ability to pay, so as not to deny full access to all Minnesotans. To any Minnesotans? Number six, focus on preventive care and early intervention to improve the health of all Minnesotans and reduce costs from untreated illnesses and diseases.
That was probably done by, it probably came from one of my original things. The legislation probably has that corrected. But and by the way, this all uses Minnesota, and obviously there are a lot of Minnesotans here, but I think the principles are, these are the documents we're using. I think the principles are the same in any state, whether these should be. And again, the focus on preventive care is key. And in my mind, prevention doesn't just mean, it doesn't just mean things like smoking cessation and early intervention. It also means appropriately delivered care. With kids getting vaccinations, if 90% of their parents are saying, yeah, go ahead, give it to them, why isn't that done by the school nurse? Instead of the parent takes time off work, picks up the kid, takes him to the clinic, gets the shot, brings him back, goes back to work. That's a terrible waste of time and money for the clinic and for the family. You save money if you deliver things appropriately, if you use nurse line, urgent care line, so you can call in the middle of the night rather than take them into the emergency room because you're not sure if it's an emergency or not.
Because of the lawyers.
Some of that, though, I've used, when our daughter, when Elsa was 6 months old, she had a very, or 2 months old, I don't know what it was, she had a very high fever, 104, something like that, and I've been told you have permanent brain damage at 105 or something. Middle of the night, we call nurse line, our health plan had it. And they say, oh, how old is she? Well, 2 or 3 months old, whatever she was. And they said, oh, well, you don't have to, kids at that age, they often have high temperature spikes. Here's what you do to take care of them. But it wasn't the emergency room. We would have taken her in the emergency room if we had no nurse to know that. That was our decision not to. It was much easier to deal with it at home. Keep going.
Number 7, ensure an adequate number of qualified healthcare professionals and facilities to guarantee availability of and timely access to quality healthcare throughout the state.
Most health reforms totally ignore the issue of access based on provider shortages as well.
Number 8, continue Minnesota's leadership in medical education, training, research, and technology. And number 9, provide adequate and timely payments to providers.
And that one is a pretty key one that actually very few health reforms talk about. Minnesota, one of the two biggest counties in our state, they have the medical journal from the Medical Society. They had a commentary in there, which I really agreed with. The guy was saying, you know, he'd like to have a single health plan that covers it, but he's real worried because our public programs always undercompensate. They pay late, everything else. How do you run a business when you get paid 6 months late for something? And payments adequate? They should be adequate. They're not for some things. We overpay. Our system is very messed up in terms of how we compensate people. But in my mind, any healthcare reform has got to factor that in. Well, these are the principles we keep in mind. I would open it up for more comments on because I'd like to hear that. That's actually very helpful to me, and I'd like that so if people are willing to stay around, but I won't focus on that right now. These principles, I think they're so important. Our healthcare reform proposal, we put them, page 1 of the bill, as requirements for what the health system has to do to stop using the healthcare system as a way of rationing by government or by health plans and so on. And I'm open to any kind of approach that meets those needs, but I think as we look at where things are, look at reforms based on principles. If you think they should be changed slightly, figure out what the principles ought to be. But in healthcare reform, there are two basic approaches. Commodity approach, healthcare is something you sell and you buy. You buy it if you can afford it, that is, or, well, maybe we can help you buy it. The other approach, but it's the market-based approach where it's a commodity. The other one's a community-based approach. It's a community need, people need it. The market approach is the one that we sort of do now. There are two major distinct factions in that, one of which would be the no government involvement or minimal government involvement. It shouldn't mandate what health insurance covers. Don't mandate things like dental care, mental health care. They say, let people shop, let them choose. If I don't have mental health problems, why should I pay for mental health coverage? Well, that's a perfect example of what's wrong with that, because most people with mental illness don't know they have mental illness and they're not going to pay for it. And frankly, in my interest, if you have mental illness and you're getting treated for it, then if we ignore it. But their approach is that no government involvement, minimal. If we have minimal coverage, more people can afford it because it would be more affordable. There are problems with this on pre-existing conditions where people can't afford insurance. They usually say they should do what Minnesota and other states do. They have a high-risk pool and you pay more, but you will still cover you for it. It's a patchwork system. I'm not real fond of it. People who are unable to afford insurance, depending on how much they feel about we ought to have universal care, they'll say, oh, we'll subsidize them. But a lot of people in this mode say, the market will take care of it. If you can't afford health care, that's tough. There's some who say, oh, well, we can find a way to deal with it. The supporters of this approach tend to very much include the prescription drug industry, largely the insurance industry. The approaches they tend to take in recent years are much more health savings account. We're going to have very high deductible plans, $10,000 health care deductible plan. That's not health insurance, that's catastrophic insurance coverage, perhaps. But you then have a health savings account to spend the money ahead of time. That's one approach to divide it up in a partisan way. That tends to be a Republican approach. There are very few Democrats who support that. The next approach is much more bipartisan, and it is also the market-based approach, and that is we're going to have a market competition between health plans. They're going to save money by negotiating for the best rates. And we hold down costs that way. Minnesota, we this past year came up with a new twist. Instead of negotiating, the health plans negotiating, which is where you get that price disparity you pointed out, instead of having help Blue Cross negotiate this $20,000 thing, we'll pay $18,000, and a different one, my health partners, negotiate $16,000 for, instead of holding costs down by that, because there's a lot of cost shifting, people, they make up the cost one way or another, instead of that, they're suggesting we ought to drop that, have price disparity, disclosure, total price disclosure. Doctors can set whatever rates they want, providers can set whatever rates they want, and then the public will shop around. It will give much more information, will evaluate. It's kind of like No Child Left Behind, which scares me for healthcare. But we're going to evaluate every doctor, every procedure, every everything else, and then people are going to somehow have an ability to shop around, get the best quality, best prices, and they're going to, they always talk about, it's counterintuitive that you get the best prices and the best quality together. It often works the opposite. Quickly, a minute.
Okay, but if that's the way the system, and you are sick, how much energy are you going to have to do this research?
I can go into the problems with that, but there's the other problem I have with that is, I was at a conference at the University of Minnesota, one or two of the national experts was hearing from some of our legislative leadership who were pushing this, and he asked them, can you give me one study, one peer-reviewed study from anywhere in the world that suggests your approach to healthcare reform is going to save money? Mm-hmm. The guy said, well, I'd like to make a couple of points. And then the guy said, well, but could you give me one peer-reviewed study that says this is going to work? And, well, let me make a couple more points. But never responded to the person. I don't think it works. This one, there's a strong support for it from health consultants who figured out this scheme. I don't think it works. But legislative leadership, bipartisan, the governor and our leadership negotiated that this past year. The other approach, since I've run out of time, I have to be very quick on this, the community approach where it's a need. The analogy I'd make is how we deal with other public needs. Water utilities, something everybody needs. We all have a system that works for everybody on it. May not be perfect, not equal access totally, but we have a public system for that. Police and fire is the other one. 150, 200 years ago, some eastern cities, Boston, Philadelphia, had fire insurance. You had different fire companies. You'd buy insurance from one of them. Your house catches on fire. They come out, put out your fire. The problem is always if the neighbor's house catches fire from yours and they have a different fire company. And what you have, the analogy I use for the way it ought to be is the way we deal with police. You have a burglary in your house or your neighbor's house. You quickly call the police. It's in progress. Got a burglary happening. The police don't answer the phone. Do you have police insurance? If you have police insurance, does it cover burglary? What's the copayment? I mean, they don't talk about it. Which plan do you have? They don't ask the questions. They come out. And the approach would be that it's something everybody needs. Everybody gets it. It would be one, in one case, it would be one plan that contracts with all the providers. They all deliver the care. It negotiates. It saves the money by negotiating fairly, saves money through administrative costs and so on. This one has wide opposition from industry, very wide, especially insurance industry, pharmaceutical industry, certain parts of medical supply industry and so on. It's got, and a lot of medical providers, though in Minnesota and most states, there's growing support among medical providers who are sick of what we're doing. They'd like a different approach. There was a survey in the Minnesota Medical Association Journal last year. 65% of Minnesota doctors now feel this would be the best way to deliver it. I think there's a lot of popular support. Our bill I'll talk about more tomorrow. But I went over time, and I apologize for that. I think we have about 5 minutes for discussion, comments, questions, concerns.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't think anyone's going to disagree with any of your proposals for the concepts, but as like a concrete system, especially with a timetable, what's the likelihood that any of this gets done, and if so, when?
We've got, in my plan, which again, I'll go into more of the politics of that tomorrow, but my plan is one that we've got a three-year strategy. We're running treating the issue like a campaign. We figured we have zero chance of passing it now. The hurdle we have to get over the wall is so big, no state has done it. All states, when we started our healthcare commission this past year, first thing we do is we have people come in and look at what other states are doing. Maybe we'll copy them. I'm saying, well, you know, other states haven't succeeded either. Why don't we look at somebody who's doing it rather than somebody who's not? The odds are very great against it, but the crisis is so bad that the pressure in favor of it is building momentum. We have more than a third, more than a quarter, almost a third now of the legislature co-authoring my bill on this. So it's significant. It's not legislative leadership yet, but a third of the legislature is pretty significant numbers. We think there's broad support in the community for it. Again, you'll have horrendous amounts of money spent against it, which makes that big wall more intimidating. But the closer you get to it, the more they fight, the more the pressure builds up on the other side, because, again, people are going bankrupt because of health care. That frontline show I mentioned yesterday, five different countries, every one, they asked a health care provider expert in that country, how many people go bankrupt from health care here? And they look at you strange. What do you mean go bankrupt from health care? And people get the care they need. They go to the doctor, they go to the dentist, they go to the pharmacist, they go to the physical therapist, whatever. So, yeah, it's a very big uphill battle. I think it's one that if we don't fix it, we're in deeper trouble.
So yet. Is there a recommendation to move to a different country?
What?
Yeah.
Recommendations, we fix the problem because we got to do something soon. Here.
So. I'll probably sound a little facetious, but from a strictly a strategic standpoint, how about if you make number 9 number 1?
It's interesting because when I put these together, I was trying to figure out everything you have to include in the principles. And I put that down there, and lots of people looked at me, why does that matter? It does matter, and it should matter. I mean, it should matter. I don't think it's not trying to buy support for doctors. I don't think most of the doctors who support a plan like this have any clue that that's even mentioned there. But it has to happen because the way we've done healthcare is ignored it. Maybe it should be number 1. That's part of the mechanics of it. To me, the first couple of them
explain. It seems less an afterthought.
Yeah, it's not an afterthought.
Yeah, no.
You're right. I think that's an important point. Strategically, you're a good point.
Do you have a website, and do you have this and other information on that, if you do?
Yes.
Do we have
a website?
Yeah, and what was the second part?
Do you have this and other information related to your plan?
MNHealthPlan.org, like me in the beginning. MNHealthPlan.org is not my site, but we actually have a whole campaign of people working on this and a lot of organizations doing it. We're trying to pull people like Isaiah and other groups that have spelled out their values to say, here's the next step eventually. But I can give you more information. I have some on it here. Over there.
I haven't heard any comments about tort reform or pharmaceutical advertising.
Sure.
For health workers like nurses and social workers or corporate physical therapists.
Sure.
Insurance overhead.
Yeah. I certainly did not talk about a majority of factors that you could count when you're talking about cost containment. Pharmaceutical industry, actually our bill, which I'll get into tomorrow, I don't mean to keep saying that, but we actually have a plan that if you direct-to-consumer market pharmaceuticals, it can't be covered by the plan. And since this is the plan, in effect, if you're going to farm direct-to-market to consumers in Minnesota, the local Time magazine, the local TV stations, newspapers, whatever, if you're going to advertise direct to consumers, nobody in Minnesota will get coverage for it, so why would you do it? In effect, it's a terrible waste of money, the direct to consumer marketing. We approach that way.
It's very profitable for the pharmaceutical companies.
I know, they don't like our bill. That's a modest way of putting it. And you said several other ones that I could go into them, but tort reform, it is a portion of our problem. It's all of the claims and settlements in Minnesota in the past year were about half of what Bill McGuire, the head of United Health Group, made in a year. $50 million. He made over $100 million last year he worked there. It is a significant issue. This plan would help some because one of the reasons we have a tort system is to compensate people not just for the lost wages but for their medical costs. If you have $2 million of medical costs over your lifetime, we're currently taking that out through the tort system. Under this plan, it's covered under the plan. So, but you're right. I didn't get into all those because there's no way we could get into all those. But it's a very good point. There are 100 different things you could talk about in cost and what's driving the cost up. Other things quickly. Yeah.
Are you familiar with the California Nurses Association's Cheney Care?
I've seen their ads, which are very creative.
I think they're wonderful.
We're probably running out of time. I just had kind of three. I'm one of the 65 Minnesota physicians who agree with just about everything you said. There's just a few things that are also obstacles here. I mean, the tort reform thing is, it's in physicians' mind every hour during the day. And it drives spending.
You're right, it drives procedures.
If you go into the ER with a migraine headache, you've had migraine headaches all your life, you're likely to get a CAT scan before you get out of it. Even though the doctor takes time and finds out it's a migraine, it's too demoralizing to get sued. And they're not going to run that 0.5% risk if there's something else wrong here.
I agree there's a problem there. Yeah. It's not a simple one to just say we cap it, because we've cut benefit. Every time you cap it, every state that caps it, the rates keep going up anyway. And
the other thing I just want to throw the quick thing, what is prevention? I think our country has to get away from the mentality that the medical system is responsible for their wellness. I mean, it says in the book of John, the well have no need of a physician. It's really true. In cardiac care, lifestyle changes have had a bigger impact on decreasing mortality than our technology, actually. And it's not a mystery. You don't have to go to the doctor. You don't have to go to the healthcare facility to find out. You can get educated. You've got to do a lot of that yourself. And the third thing is, we have a mentality in our country we have an insatiable desire to live as long as we can. And there's a this idea that it's somehow easy to move somebody into hospice when they got cancer is hard work. We have a mentality that you won't give up. And there's a no give up.
It's patient view and medical fields view largely.
No, yeah. It's hard work to take somebody, even if you have a fetal disease. I'll get another opinion. So that's going on. The other thing I just say is that the other thing that's discouraging is, I was talking to Michael Pellet a couple of days ago, who's a seminary professor in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. He's on the commission in Saskatchewan having to do with healthcare. And we have everybody has access. The physicians there are seeing 70 or 80 patients a day. I have a busy day if I see 20, 25. They're down to 6.5 minutes a visit. And they're getting discouraged. So I just need to say that to illustrate the public really did this.
I'll close by saying two comments on your last two. I already commented on the first one. The one about the prevention. It is a personal responsibility thing we have to do. It's actually a shared responsibility. If I don't have a overweight problem. Some people who do, though, it's not because I'm a better person than them. Sometimes people can't, whether because of medication or mental health or addictive behavior, whatever, a whole range of factors. So we really have to push the personal and society responsibility to try and keep us as a community healthier. But we should not say, well, if you're going to smoke, then we're not going to take care of your health, which is what some people say we should do. I think we should push very, very heavily on it, but we shouldn't discriminate against people based on it. And then the final one you had was, repeat quickly.
Oh, Canada.
Quick visits and so on. Yes.
Not enough providers.
Providers rushing, which we have a problem with that here, too. We don't have, again, as I mentioned earlier, in your place where they have the heart program, we don't give people the time to spend with the patient where you can have that discussion. And Canada and a lot of these countries, Japan has like five times as many medical visits as we do per capita. They're very brief, but they have five times as many. I'm not saying we should copy them that way, because they have the same problem Canada and others do, and that is that the system shortchanges the funding. I'm proposing a system that I think would be 80% as expensive what we have, not 60%. I think they should be spending more in appropriate ways to get that to happen, and I'll talk tomorrow about how we're trying that. But it's a very good point. You don't want to have, it's not quantity, it's quantity and quality combined. And cost. So, I'm sorry we didn't have more time for more discussion. I'll stay around here some now, and again tomorrow I'll be talking about direct items.